your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a really fine guest. He's been with us several times. He's one of our favorites. Welcome back to our program, Greg Palaz.
Glad to be with you, George.
Boy, I tell you what, you have come up with some, tell our listening audience that hadn't heard you a little bit about your background for a few minutes. Yeah, tell us.
Okay, for those who don't know Greg Palaz, I'm an investigative reporter, the old-fashioned kind. I usually report for the BBC television out of London or the British paper, The Guardian. But this is a piece, and I've written some books, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, and I have a little film out called Vultures and Vote Rustlers. And I was not surprised to see that Chris Christie was in hot water, so I decided to do a little investigating of my own. And so I wrote a piece, why is Chris Christie and David Koch, why are they in my driveway?
Boy, and I'll tell you what, you come up with some amazing connections in this. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't. I mean, you're just really, in the best sense, an investigative reporter on a deep level. What do you think?
I do the old-fashioned type of investigative reporting. In fact, I was an investigator before I was an investigative reporter. So I do the old, get the inside documents, undercover work often. And I've been covering and investigating the Koch brothers since 1995.
Okay.
And so who are, they're two of the richest guys on the planet. In fact, there's three of them. People. There's Charles and David, who are reportedly worth $22 billion each. And their little brother, Billy, is worth, I don't know how much, $3 to $4 billion. Part of that, there's a little bit of anger between them because there are four brothers who are supposed to split daddy's billions four ways, but somehow two brothers ended up with all the loot. But I've been following these guys, and back in 1995 and 96, there was, for those of us old enough to remember, Newt Gingrich had just taken over Congress for the first time in a half century. Democrats had taken control of the House of Representatives, and looked like they might lose it. But then suddenly, in the 96 midterm election, a whole bunch of money suddenly appeared, smearing a lot of Democratic candidates. Now, some of the smears were real, like one ad accused a congressman of beating his wife. And by the way, that was true.
But it was
pretty nasty stuff in there at the last second, and people didn't know where this was coming from. All they knew is that it was a group called Committee for Our Children's Future.
Right.
And all these people concerned about our children's future somehow decided to go after these vulnerable Democrats, and the Republicans then kept control of the House. Now, there was an investigation by a Republican senator, actually, Senator Fred Thompson. The guy's played, he played the prosecutor on Law and Order. When he was in the U.S. Senate, he thought he played the prosecutor on TV so many times he actually thought he was one. So he decided to investigate. And what he discovered was Campaign for Our Children's Future was, in fact, just a fake front set up by Koch Industries, by the Koch brothers. Now, at that time, that was illegal to use corporate money. It's since legal. It now is legal since Supreme Court decision in 2010. But at the time, it was illegal. So Fred Thompson, and I have to say, this is one time I have to applaud someone who rose above his party. He said, I don't care whether it's Republicans or Democrats. These guys have broken the law. Unfortunately, you say, so then why weren't they busted and in prison? Well, if you go back to one of my books, those who haven't read Greg Palast's book, there's a book, The Best Democracy Money to Buy, which explains it. Bill Clinton had his own illegal money coming to his campaign. The Democrats were getting money from China, from the Riotti family, Chinese Indonesians. And so the Democrats and Republicans, in the bipartisan spirit, got together and decided, you don't touch our billionaires, we don't touch your billionaires. So the Riottis walked free, and so did the Koch brothers. Now, why do we care about what happened almost 20 years ago? The answer is, this past year, Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, and now he's now become infamous for blocking the George Washington Bridge from New Jersey to New York City, the world's busiest bridge, and he was upset with a Democratic mayor who would not endorse him for governor. So to punish the mayor, he basically had a he basically shut off part of the bridge and backed up, you know, literally half a million people. It's hard to imagine how big this bridge is. He backed up about 500,000 people crossing the bridge to punish this mayor because the bridge ends in this town. Now that was done by Christie's staff. They're still investigating to see whether he knew about it. But what interested me besides this really awful prank of closing the bridge, which is what people seem to be interested in, is Christie's attempted run for president. You know, he clearly wants to run for president. And there were a bunch of ads on the air last year and in 2012 promoting Chris Christie as the most wonderful governor that's ever graced the United States of America. And these TV ads were run by a group. No one could figure out who these people were. But they call themselves Committee for Our Children's Future.
Oh, God.
So what happened was the New York Times said, oh, Committee for Our Children's Future, they asked the governor's people, say, oh, that's just friends of his from college. Well, I don't know about your friends from college, but apparently these friends of Christie found $6 million to run TV ads. Now, these are not rich guys. Where did they get $6 million? Well, the money's clearly tracing back to our old friends, the Koch brothers, three of them, Charles, David, and Billy Koch, were backing Chris Christie. This committee does not have to say where its money comes from. It's all secret, but we know that the trail goes back to the Koch brothers. And one other guy known as the Vulture, nice name, Paul the Vulture Singer, who seems to be working with the Kochs. So I'm interested, not whether, yes, it's if Chris Christie, if the governor of New Jersey blocks a bridge as a political stunt, that's pretty awful. In fact, it's illegal, but it's still just a crazy prank. This is, I think, much more dangerous. Do we have hidden secret billionaire money directing our elections? In other words, they're selling us Chris Christie. Now, he may be a good governor, he may be a bad governor. What I don't like is the use of secret funds and a false cover that your friends are so happy with you that they're spending $6 million to tell the world how wonderful you are. I think it's, while there are subpoenas being dropped on Christie's staff for information about the bridge closing, I think that the subpoenas should also demand the information on who put up this money.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Boy, that would be well. You know, they're saying that the money was used for ads, but that it was cleared by the White House. Now, have you heard this or read this?
No, I haven't seen. I haven't seen any White House, because this obviously Christie is very much not the White House. But the Democrats have their, like I say. Both parties are getting
the money came out of the funding for Hurricane Sandy. Is that right?
Well, there were other ads
okay.
that were about how wonderful Christy was,
yeah.
Which come out of the hurricane money, because it was supposedly money to say, oh, look how, you know, New Jersey's back. What they do is they put Chris Christie, this big blob on the TV, and say, come
yeah.
on to New Jersey. We're back in business.
Right.
Well,
oh,
is,
yeah.
Is he selling New Jersey, or is he selling his own face? You know, that's the gimmick here. So politicians, that's an old gimmick. We saw that after the Gulf spill, when you had Governor Jindal and other governors get up there using recovery money to say, we love, look at how well our state's doing, even if it wasn't. So, you know, these politicians always use, figure out a way to get on TV with public money. Now, this money I'm concerned about is coming from these billionaires. So, yeah,
right.
So Christy, one question is, that's a good second, you actually brought up a good second point, which is the use of public money.
Right. He's saying that he shouldn't have used it for ads. He should have used it for rebuilding or something because of Hurricane Sandy. You know,
yeah. They, you know, we don't need ads saying that New Jersey, you know, that New Jersey is back in shape. Let's see, you know, if you go into Newark, New Jersey these days,
yeah.
you're not going to see, you know, it's not exactly lovely.
No, it's
it didn't
not.
Need a, first of all, I got to tell you something.
It's a hood, isn't it?
Or not.
Yeah.
Actually, I'll tell you. And you go into Newark, their state capital.
Right.
And I think it would, you know, there's a lot of people who think it would be improved by a hurricane. I mean, it is.
Yeah,
it is that.
It's a hood. So it's a slum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see Christie take care of the economics of New Jersey instead of, you know, going. What he's doing, he's taking care of the economics of the billionaires. That's
yes.
the problem.
Yes. Right.
Now,
he's taking money that he should have used for the hurricane and promoting himself through some ads for come return to New Jersey, see?
Yeah, like who goes
yeah.
to vacation?
Come back
Jersey
to New Jersey and we're rebuilding, but it's about him and his political campaign and
right.
his image. It's image.
Now, and one of the things we also found, and by the way, if you get the full article.
Okay.
If you go to gregpalast.com, G-R-E-G.
Okay.
P-A-L-A-S-T. If you go to gregpalast.com, you get the full article. I'm sure
Good.
Jersey put it up on your site to
we'll
link
put,
to it.
Yeah, it's up right now, yeah.
And he went off. The governor of New Jersey went off secretly, not telling anyone on the staff, not putting in his schedule, that he had run off to Vail, Colorado, to a dinner being held by the Kochs with a bunch of billionaires. So it was David Koch and Charles Koch and Foster Freeze, another billionaire. There were several billionaires there. At this secret meeting in Vail, it was a closed meeting, but a friend of mine, Brad Friedman, a great journalist, was able to get a tape recording of this secret meeting. So I know what Christie said, and basically he was saying, you know, I'll never tax millionaires. He actually said, I'm totally against the millionaires tax, and here's all these billionaires, I'm sure they were thrilled.
Right.
You know, and then of course he says, we got to cut Social Security and cut Medicare and cut Medicaid. Well, he didn't talk about cutting Social Security when he was governor. This is all in private meetings with these rich guys. Now, if you have a position, you can be for cutting Social Security. That's your view. But why are you just telling the billionaires? If that's your position, like, come out and say it, as opposed to, like, I won't tax you, but I'll cut Social Security so you don't have to pay taxes. All right, then say that publicly. But it was
right.
all done in secret. And obviously these guys then decided to reward him. That night they collected $70 million from the people at that dinner. $70 million in one evening for the Koch's political action campaign called Americans for Prosperity, probably their prosperity. But once again we see this front groups, and then this money starts coming into these front groups, and I cannot, you know, I would like the Koch's to say yes or no about whether they are the money behind it, because it's pretty clear this is their pattern, their boy, mystery money, same name of the group that they used as a front before. Let's get to the truth of this. Let's subpoena these guys.
Right. He was palsy wowsy with Barack Obama there around the Sandy hurricane storm, wasn't he? I mean, right after.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were
yeah,
putting
I mean,
their arms around each other. I mean, they're palsy wowsy, right?
Yeah, well, that was, see, because
a show,
after the hurricane,
a show. Yeah.
right? There was all this money that came into New Jersey.
He needed that money, yeah.
Yeah, and Christie was, you know, it's a Democratic state, and Christie's a Republican. He's running for re-election, so he thought, well, it was a couple weeks before the election. Romney's going down. So it was one of these kind of craven deals in which he's basically giving a boost to the obvious winner who's going to clean up all the votes in his state. So he wants to be seen with Obama. This is a, I mean, you don't need to have your picture taken with Obama on the coast to go fix up to go save lives. That's just distraction in the middle of a crisis. That's right. Nonsense. That's complete nonsense.
Sure.
It was political. It was a ridiculous political stunt in the middle of a crisis.
Sure.
You know, it reminds me of when during Hurricane Katrina, when and I was down there, Bush showed up to hold a press conference. President Bush, there was no light, there was no power in the city, none. And the military flew in all these generators with big lights so he could make a speech, but everyone else was in the dark. You know, I mean, this is the type of stunt. And so Christie and Obama were playing the same look at me stunt.
Oh, man, that's sickening. And I bet if they did an audit of those Hurricane Sandy funds, where would they, did they go to the places they were supposed to or not?
Well, some did, but unfortunately, you know, this is the problem, especially in New Jersey. The connected contractors get the money.
Right.
And, of course, they hire these PR firms who, instead of promoting New Jersey,
right,
are promoting Christie. That's the game.
Yeah. God.
You know, so we're basically paying for our tax money for political ads. And it's
right,
boosted by the Committee for Our Children's Future. Well, maybe when they say our children's future, maybe the Koch brothers' children, not our children. So, you know, this is, you know, look, this is how the game is played, but my job as a journalist is to expose it.
Boy, you've done a fine job on this. That's excellent reporting, Greg.
Well, thank you very much. I got to get on to the next one.
Okay.
And anyway, great show, George. I really appreciate
you
giving me this
platform. Thank you very much for coming on with us at such short notice, Greg. We certainly appreciate it.
Fantastic.
Anytime. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
You're the best. Bye.
Good night. Once again, Greg Palast, thank you very much for that quick interview. You know, we know that you were pressed hard and you squeezed us in, and boy, you're the best, you know. I tell you what, Greg. And I want our listening audience to go back in our archives and listen to that, what he said about this secret meeting that Chris Christie had out in Vail, Colorado. That was very, very interesting information. What follows is a three-minute clip with New Jersey Assemblyman Wyniski with on Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer. It's about a three-minute clip, and then we'll come back and discuss that a little bit and go from there. Okay, here we go right now.
Governor Christie's point was he did not know. Do you think that's possible?
Good morning, Bob, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. I don't think it's credible for a governor to have his chief of staff, his communication director, his deputy chief of staff, all involved, his chief counsel, all involved in email communications on the day this took place and the days after, talking not only about the problems that were created in Fort Lee, but also talking about how to spin it to the press. I don't think it's possible for all of those people to be involved and know, and for the governor to absolutely have no communication. Remember, this was in the midst of his reelection campaign. Any governor running for reelection is going to want to know about problems that come up, if for no other reason, to know how to respond when asked a question. So these people got an email from the executive director of the Port Authority saying that laws were broken. His chief counsel knew. His deputy chief of staff knew. His incoming chief of staff knew. It just strains credibility that they didn't look at those documents and say, we ought to let him know about it.
So at this point, though, and you're very early in your investigation, you don't have any proof that he did know. But from what you're saying, if it proves that he did know, then what? Has a crime been committed here?
Well, whether he knew or not isn't the issue of crime. And clearly, in my opinion, when you use the George Washington Bridge for what the email showed to be a political payback, that amounts to using public property for a private purpose or for a political purpose, and that's not legal. And so that constitutes a crime. Now, whether or not he was knowledgeable about it, whether he authorized it, whether he was involved in trying to spin it or cover it up, we don't have any direct communication, emails, documents that directly go to him.
Well, could he, if it turns out that this is, as you define it, a crime, could he be impeached, or what would be the penalty?
Well, I think we're a little early on that, Bob. I think you pointed out at the beginning we're at the early stages of this. But clearly, if it becomes known that the governor was involved and he knew about it and he knew about the cover-up and he was approving the actions taken by his senior staff, that raises serious questions that the assembly ought to look at. And that ought to be considered in light of what our responsibility is. The assembly has the ability to do articles of impeachment. We're way ahead of that, though. Right now, we know that there are senior staffers in the governor's office. Bridget Kelly, who sent the email, his deputy chief of staff, on August 13 to close the lanes down, she spent the rest of the day with the governor at the fire scene at the Seaside Boardwalk. And so, again, you know, this senior aide who was with him that day, who sent the order, never once communicated with him. It's unbelievable.
All right. Well, Mr. Assemblyman, I want to thank you for being with us.
Okay. What Wodniski said, the assemblyman there, the Jersey assemblyman, said they have no actual proof right now. I mean, there's emails floating around throughout his top staff, Chris Christie's top staff, on the bridge closing and so forth. And so most of his staff knew about it. Wodniski seemed to indicate that if most all of his staff knew about it, then probably Chris Christie knew about it, but there's no definitive, smoking gun that has an actual, you know, email to him disclosing that that he did absolutely know about it. So we'll just have to wait. It'll take a little time for that to work out. We're going to be holding a Fukushima Solutions World Conference here in Austin, Texas, on March 8th and 9th, 2014. And we'll be also marketing some T-shirts to help pay for this and help finance this conference. We're going to have approximately 4 to 6 on-site, on-stage speakers, very fine speakers. We'll come in, we'll fly them in. The majority of 15 to 20 additional speakers will be Skyped in over live connections, and there'll be a few, 3 or 4 possibly, that will be pre-recorded because it's just impossible sometimes to get some of these people in live on a live Skype connection. So we'll have an audience, an auditorium on the campus of the University of Texas. And so we'll make that known, that particular exact location, known in the next few days or before the end of the month for sure. But probably no longer than another week, 10 days, we'll have that location nailed down. And we'll be able to tell you all about it at that time. Right now, we have two guests pretty well confirmed. Well, confirmed for sure, Dr. John Apsley, okay? And Dr. John Apsley is a physician, author, and researcher who for the past 30 years has specialized in regenerative medicine. His cutting-edge techniques are designed to reverse chronic degenerative disease through accelerated tissue repair and cellular regeneration. His latest book happens to be Fukushima Meltdown. And that's where I first became aware of him. We interviewed him here a few weeks ago on the Secret Truth Radio here in Austin, Texas. But, yeah, he's the author of Fukushima Meltdown and Modern Radiation, Protecting Ourselves and Our Future Generations. He holds degrees in medicine, chiropractic, DC, and nutrition, and he's all kinds of board certifications and stuff. The other speaking guest that we have for sure, Dr. William Deagle. He has his own Nutri medical program on GCN Network, and he's a profile pro-life physician. He's been a board-certified family medicine specialist, board-eligible occupational environmental medicine, internal medicine, all kinds. His credentials are overwhelming. He's probably one of the most profound people in nuclear medicine, being able to describe it really down to the nth degree. NutriMedical.com is his website, and he's out there for truth and wellness. And ClayandIron.com is another one of his sites. Anyway, those are two confirmed. We're talking to Arne Gunnarsson right now, and we'll probably Skype him in. He's pretty busy. He's got cases that he testifies in, and he might be busy during that particular weekend, but we're talking about Skyping him in or pre-recording him. Also, Helen Caldicott, we're in negotiations with her. We'd like to have her Skyped in from Australia if she's not in the country. And we might be able to fly her in as one of the people that we can do that with. The overall theme of the program will be World Solution Needed. And what we intend to do is have the first day, that would be March 8th, will be the Fukushima site itself, how to remediate that site and how to go about fixing that site. And so site remediation will be the first day, March 8th. The second day, March 9th, will be on personal health issues. And that's where Helen Caldicott and that plethora of other physicians and medical doctors will have a great input. We believe that that site remediation of the Fukushima should have started immediately, as far as trying to get the word out to what was really going on over there. Well, Charlotte Littlefield and myself, we started immediately on this problem, and we were right there at the very beginning, doing extraordinarily. We were really genuine the first few months on this. Within a day, this happened on a Friday. The next Saturday, we had an interview with a tsunami director in Hawaii. We followed that up with a couple of interviews with our Air Force officers, one in northern Japan and one in the Tokyo area. We began to understand this hazmat team was flying in. The dependents were allowed to leave. It was very serious business at the first few weeks on the onset of this catastrophe. And it is a major catastrophe. There's another, we do have a t-shirt coming out in the next few weeks. We'll have it up on our site, and it basically will have Fukushima Daiichi, is the actual, exact name of that particular plant. Say, when you look at all the plants all over, Japan, there's so many. And so there is another Fukushima plant, okay? There's two actually in the area. There's Daiichi. Fukushima Daiichi is where the major power failure occurred and the disaster occurred. Then there's Fukushima Daini power plant, which is about 7 miles north of the Fukushima Daiichi. We're going to be focusing in on Fukushima Daiichi. Fukushima Daini, which is north, 7 miles north, barely made it through the, after the tsunami. They miraculously shut down their, you know, nuclear reactors. But Fukushima Daiichi was not that fortunate, and it resulted in what we see today as a total catastrophe. And there's no other word to put it. We believe that the Japanese committed a fatal error in managing this disaster, in the sense that they should have called for, I believe the disaster was a world disaster, and it required a world solution or a world response. I believe that the Japanese should have, within months, within 3 to 4 or 5 months, called an international convention and tried to bring the top experts from all over the world into a meeting. We could have had it in the United States to stay out of the area of the radiation. And I believe convening an international convention at that time should have been done. I made appeals to certain state and U.S. representatives here in Texas, but I got no response at that time from the people that I approached to do this. Later that year, 2011, I came up with the idea to hold our own conference, and I failed in doing that, but now I'm finally getting to it, but about a year and a half, a year and 10, 12 months too late, I feel. But anyway, this conference that we're going to have it on the campus of the University of Texas is hopefully going to be a conference that can call attention to this disaster. But not only doing that, but it can result in a possible much larger conference being held. We're going to bring in people that are of the, say, Helen Caldicott. We're trying to get her to come either by Skype or in person. We can't hardly have, we don't have the budget at this time to fly her in from Australia. If she happens to be in the country, we'd love to have her here at the conference. If not, we could always Skype her in from Australia, or we could Skype her in from anywhere in the country that she might be at the time. She represents an anti-nuclear, beyond nuclear type of answer, and she's totally against nuclear power and nuclear weapons, and she's on that peace side totally. And I can't say that I'm not on that side anymore myself. I mean, I think that this nuclear material that is being used is just the half-life and all that. It's just way, way out there. It's very caustic, and for humans, it's very detrimental to our health, to say the least. There's all kinds of news coming in from different sites now, and Alex Jones sent a team out last week to the West Coast, and at Oceanside, California, there on one of the beaches, they got a reading that was 7 or 8 times what it should have been. And so, that's been duplicated by other people. There was some kind of a dark silt looking sand that they were getting a high reading from, so we don't know exactly what that was from. The tuna and the fish, I would not recommend personally, from what I've learned studying this disaster for nearly 3 years, or catastrophe, we should say. I would not eat Pacific Ocean seafood whatsoever, because it's just too risky, especially tuna and these fish that have a long range. They range quite a distance, so they could easily get contaminated. And there's no sense in trying to eat fish, or even unknowingly and unwittingly and enter your body with material that could be very toxic. The problem with radioactivity, and I'm not an expert at this, I'm getting this from some of the finest doctors in the world, is that you may have a small amount of cesium or whatever, but it may not be that dangerous by itself. But if it lodges inside the body and stays there, it's 24 hours a day that you're getting that radioactivity. Over an accumulative period of time, it can be very detrimental to your health. And this is what all the experts say. There's going to be a food crisis also, possibly on the West Coast. They were importing food from Japan, which is just not a good idea to eat any foods from Japan. They were even feeding young school children. The Caldicott Foundation last year had a symposium in New York City, and it was stated there by Folker, that that they fed to the children of Japan, some of the school children, some contaminated food until they realized it was contaminated and they stopped. But they also exported to this country certain food that we don't know for sure that was contaminated or not. So we don't know for sure whether there was contaminated food, taken in, ingested by our population. So there's a possibility that also happened. But to say the least, we've got to be very careful with products coming in from Japan, especially food products like that. And I would not recommend to ingest those whatsoever. The Fukushima, okay, Daiichi, was an extraordinarily great tragedy in the sense that the building of that site was too low to the ocean for the extraordinarily high tsunami wave that hit that plant. They had made mistakes in locating generators in basements and pumps in basements, and when that wave hit, it just took out all of that. The pumps went on immediately after the earthquake hit and disconnected or put down some of their electricity, knocked down some of that. So after that, then it automatically came on, the diesels and so forth. Then about 20 minutes later or something, 25, 30 minutes later, the big wave hit. And so when that wave hit, it just swept over the seawall into the plant, flooded the plant and the basement, and caused the generators to totally short out. And the pumps were down there, too, so it took out those motors. If the plant's diesels had been up higher at a level that would have been operative, even if the plant had been flooded, it's very likely it could have survived the tsunami and the earthquake and been closed down properly and not experienced this extraordinary radioactive catastrophe. Right now, no one knows for sure how much radiation is being put out. It's far more than Chernobyl ever experienced. We've got multiple generators there and meltdown situations versus one in Chernobyl. So the amount of radiation is continuing. This is what makes it dangerous. We see a concerted effort from the very beginning to stifle the press, to put a lid on it, to not report everything properly, either on the Japanese public, to the Japanese public, or to the American public. To allow dependents to go in there, especially in the Air Force base around Tokyo, I think was unconscionable. I think it was bad policy, and I think it's going to prove to be a major mistake. And I think there could be very great legal possibilities against the federal government for U.S. government for allowing dependents back in there. I don't think dependents should have ever been allowed to go back to Japan, period. I think the exposure problem and risk was too great to do that. And I just think it's a very, very tragic situation that occurred to allow them to go back. I mean, tragic, yeah. I think it was just a basic error in judgment by our government. And they should have never allowed our dependents to go back to Japan. In the northern Japan, we have some bases, and they're pretty well out of the way of the contamination. Yoshi Shimatsu, who testifies on another talk show, he's Japanese. He reports for, I think, Third Media out of Beijing and Hong Kong. He's saying that he had a little cabin up in the mountain, his family did, and the last time they went up there, they tested the water and found out the water that they coming off the mountainside was contaminated with radioactivity at too high a level to drink. And in Japan, I think most of the drinking water is comes off of those mountains, the snow melt and so forth. So much of the water there could easily be contaminated, but it's not being widely publicized. Now, early on, you had Safecast, which was a company out of California that went out and did surveys over there and went around and drove around throughout the country taking radioactive readings. Today, we have several teams from Safecast and other companies and so forth that have given low-cost radiation detectors to people living in different parts of Japan, and they're beginning to take readings. Also, on the West Coast, more and more people are beginning to take readings, especially along the sea coast where there could be problems of contamination of the Pacific. The fisheries in the northern part of the Pacific there could have easily been contaminated, and we have reports of fish kills, of large fish kills in certain areas. There are different reports also of fish containing radioactivity levels that are abnormal, and also, you know, sores and, you know, things like this are being reported by people that are catching fish that are suffering problems because of radiation. The radiation that was put out or still continuing to spew forth from Fukushima is an extraordinarily high amount of radiation. Once the radiation, as I understand it, is out into the world, you can't take it back out of the world. There are people out of Salt Lake City, David Yurth, he was on our program within weeks after the catastrophe at Fukushima, and he was stating that they did have ways to remediate waste, and they could remediate some of that radioactivity, water, and things like this. But the Japanese are going to have to open up in a big way this problem to a world solution, and that's where we come in. That's where we're going to go with our conference in March, on March 8th and 9th. We want truly a world answer to this, truly a world, you know, solution. Now, with all the radiation that's already spewed forth, we can't take that back. All we can do is hope to try to reduce that to a manageable level of, and then also we need to get the warning out to more and more people about the dangers, personal health dangers that will exist, that are beginning to get more and more prevalent throughout the population. We're going to experience a lot of different health problems and ailments that we didn't have before because of the radiation. The radiation, in some cases, might be a low level, but if it sustains itself in one place very long, it can become a real problem. Right now, the Japanese citizens are beginning to wake up to the fact that there's a big, big problem there at Fukushima, and they're beginning to realize that their government has misled them. The problem now within the country is there's been laws enacted recently that prohibit them from speaking out about the Fukushima under penalty of imprisonment and so forth, fine and imprisonment. So they're not very, they're hesitant about speaking out about the Fukushima problem. And so this is becoming a real problem too right now in Japan. And people are afraid to speak out. The Japanese culture is a very nice culture. They're a very conforming culture. They like rules and regulations, and they follow those rules and regulations. They're very polite people. And they have a long, old culture that goes way back. And as a result, their culture is well-defined. It's a very courteous, but it's a very respectful culture of authority. And that's where perhaps the Japanese character fails in some cases. It has an affinity for belief and obeying authority figures more so than the Americans. And the Americans might say, well, prove it to me before I'm going to take orders from you. You know, they might be, the American character is from a lot of different European and Latin America, Latin countries in the Mediterranean and so forth. It's a mixture. It's a melting pot. So the American character and so forth is not as readily susceptible to just doing anything that is asked without real reason and a cause. The Japanese character is more, it has a greater susceptibility to authority than the American character overall, I would say. And as a result, it's susceptible to being manipulated and obeying authority, you know. So I believe that's one of the problems there in Japan on this. It is a problem in one way, and then it was a saving grace in another way. I don't think another culture could have survived what the Japanese have through this Fukushima and through this devastated tsunami and earthquake that occurred there. I don't think the average society could have even come close to surviving what did happen there. And another society would have just, you know, totally freaked out probably and not made it at all, you know. But they did make it through this. And as a result, they're going to be survivors. I mean, they're going to do it. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that they're going to come back from this. But there again, with Building 4 in desperate straits as far as standing there, I mean, it's a shell of a building. You ought to see the real photograph of that. It's really in sad shape. And also the extraction mechanics inside the building are not going to be able to be used to exactly extract those rods out of that that storage. The spent fuel rods are in a 100-foot storage tank of water, and they weigh they're very heavy, and they're not easy to deal with. And you have to extract them out very carefully without touching any of the other fuel rods. They've already started the extraction process, and I believe they have several of the fuel rods in the dozens is all, which were the easiest ones to get out of the storage without interrupting or causing the others to break or rub up against them and cause any major problems. If the fuel rods start becoming a problem in trying to get jammed in there and so forth, they could easily end up end up crumbling and causing a fire to be started. If the fire starts and then it starts consuming all of the remaining fuel rods and fuel in those rods, then it would put out a horrendously large amount of smoke, which would be highly radioactive. And if the smoke happened to be drifting into towards the south-south west towards Tokyo, 120-130 miles away, and then started coming down and rain on Tokyo, there'd be a tremendous loss of life in the Tokyo area. The Tokyo-Yokohama area is the largest metropolitan populated area in the world, of well over 35 million people. So you see the problem that exists is that we've got a really, really problem in trying to get this thing fixed, you know, and it's not going to be easy to fix. They're trying to work with robots in areas that they can't get into. They're going to have to just, it's going to have to be like a suicide type of mission, I believe, on some of this. And I believe that there's been dozens lost already that are not really being reported to us properly. But they're going to have to send people in harm's way, and they've already done it. And I'll give it this much to the Japanese. They have done extraordinary sacrifices on Fukushima. And there's not many other countries in the world that could have sent men in like they did to make the sacrifices they did for their country. And there's great sacrifices that we don't know about yet by those that worked early on during the greatest crisis of the catastrophe. But I would say I have high respect for the Japanese in the sense that the average working Japanese over there is very loyal to his country. And I think they love their country and their fellow man, and they've made some extraordinary sacrifices in trying to get this catastrophe under control, which had been nearly impossible to do. One problem after another, explosions, hydrogen explosion. There might have been even a small little nuclear explosion on one of those reactors, I think number two or something. They just had hell. They've had real hell with this. Now we need to mobilize, and we need to reach out to people to try to make this a world solution. And instead of letting the Chinese just, you know, die on the vine there, we've got to save the country, because it's saving the planet. The radioactive material that's contaminating through air and wind and water currents and so forth will eventually contaminate the whole world. There'll be certain areas impacted in the northern hemisphere more so than the southern, but eventually, the way the currents are, there'll be radioactivity that will be contaminating the whole world over a period of several more years. And wind and rain and stuff like that will carry the radioactive material and stuff up into the airways, to the jet streams. And you've got one jet stream that carries more water than the Amazon. I mean, water in the jet stream. And that's a tremendous river up in the upper atmospheres. Just that alone is a dynamic that can spread contamination all over the world itself. So seeking refuge just in the southern hemisphere might be a good short-term solution, but as far as a long-term solution goes, it may not. Well, it would definitely the radiation is going to reach all parts of the world eventually, but it will have certain levels higher in certain areas than others. Probably the closer to the catastrophe could possibly be the worst, and the West Coast could be a bad area. We're trying to bring the truth out here. We're part of the Secret Truth, Charlotte Littlefield and I. We're not out here to alarm people and to make people too nervous about what's going on over there. But we must face this, and we must try to convene a much larger conference. We're calling this a world conference, and we're trying to pull in some of the very, very best experts on site remediation and personal health to try to make the best out of this that we can. With the time that we have coming up in March. March 11th, 2014 will be the third anniversary of this catastrophe, and we will be there convening this about 3 days before that, the 8th and 9th, and then 2 days after that will be the three-year anniversary of the catastrophe. So we're going to try to use some of the publicity leading up to the third anniversary to focus in on what our goals and objectives are on this conference. We will be pulling in and inviting some of the world's experts, either by Skyping them in or personally have them on the stage addressing our audience. So you'll be able to come in either on the campus, and if it gets big enough, if our budget gets big enough, if it grows, if our funding grows, we'll be able to have a much larger venue and be able to expand the audience side of it and be able to provide a much larger audience view of our talk and our conference. The individuals that will be there, we hope, will be like healthcare officials, state healthcare, city, county, or whatever, would do well to come to this particular event and get some very, very good advice on how to handle personal health, you know, concerning radioactivity, how to migrate it out of the body. There's stuff like nutrients and additives and so forth, like zeolite, other things like this. There are protocols like Utopia Silver, who used to be our sponsor. They have a protocol, and many of these larger healthcare products companies on the nutrition side and vitamins and so forth, they have their own particular protocols addressing the liquidation of or the migration of radioactivity particles and materials out of the body via the waste. So it's not totally, unhopeful, without hope. But once the radiation has been in the body for a while, there is an effect. So there is some damage always from the very beginning of a dose, whether it's a low dose or a higher dose. So to get it out as quickly as possible is the objective of most medical care specialists. And to diagnose where it is, how to get it out of the system, this is what most of them are concerned with. Anyway, we want to thank all of these people that we've contacted. They've been very, very nice about and very, very informative about their studies. We're going to invite one lady in. We hope to have her Skyped in, Folkers, Cindy Folkers, who was at the other symposium, and she spoke very, very clearly, insightfully about food and how food was being checked and by what, organizations and agencies in the country. I think there was a great, focus when it first happened to check food and this and that, but then it fell off. I don't think there's as much checking of food by federal authorities as there originally was, before. So this is something that we've got to get back to, that's for sure. But, so it's an ongoing struggle. We have to continue to focus in on this. We can't keep our eyes off of it. We've got to think about this in the right way and try to exercise the best judgment and attain the best results that we can, not only to help us weather this so-called catastrophe, but try to help the Japanese put their countries back together again and help to ameliorate their high radioactivity problem there in Japan, and which is very, very great, and we need to do something to help them weather this great catastrophe. We want to thank each and every one of our listening audience out there. We love each and every one of you. We're hard hitting on some of our statements, and so we're not easy to deal with on some of these secret truth issues, so to speak. But we hope that we can tell the truth as close as possible to the actuality of truth. We're not always exactly right all the time. Who is? But we'll if y'all bring anything to our attention, bring it, email us. We have our emails there on the site, and tell us and call us on it, and we'll certainly make a correction the next broadcast that comes up. We're a weekly broadcast, Charlotte Littlefield, and I'm George Butler. We broadcast the radio program is The Secret Truth every Saturday night, 7 to 9, in Austin, Texas on 90.1 FM. So if you could just tune in next week, and we'll have more information for you, and we'll give you another update on Fukushima, and we'll have some other guests and look at our site and keep informed of our coming guests and so forth. But go to thesecrettruth.com. You'll look at the top. There's a click-off that will take you to the Fukushima World Solution World Conference. The Fukushima Solution World Conference is coming up March 8th and 9th, 2014. Thank you for listening this evening.